Jesus didn't have a problem with people that's in the streets. He had a problem with religious people.
How can I help anybody when I'm not even, when I was not even able to help my own son?
I would never do that. I would never do that. And I became that in a matter of minutes when they took my pain pills away.
And I said, I'm not where I want to be, but thank God I'm not what I used to be.
Ugh. This is Faith in Your Recovery. I am Randy Davis. Welcome to the battle. Thank you for joining with us here on Faith in Your Recovery. I'm Randy Davis. Our guest today is Rob Decker. Welcome, Rob.
Randy, thank you so much for allowing me on the show. And we misfired a couple times and had to reschedule, but here we are.
Life happens, doesn't it, one way or the other.
But it sure does.
We're going to make this work, and we're looking forward to it. Folks, Rob comes to us today from Colorado. And we've just been done talking. Their weather's not a whole lot different than ours here in East Central Indiana, at least at this moment. Who knows about tomorrow, okay? But Rob's got quite the story. I read from his book over the last couple of days and what he's got to share. Some of it's going to be a little hard to take. It's pretty graphic. We're going to be careful with our words. That's not what I mean, but just the incidents, the moment, the traumas that he's gone through. So I hope you're going to be okay with that. But as always, we want to remain raw, real, and sloppy. We don't want to cover it up. We don't want to dramatize it. We don't want to make it sound like Hollywood either, but we're just going to tell you the truth and hope you can deal with that, okay? Thanks again, as I've already said, for tuning in. So, Rob, why don't you start us off here? Who were you before the Great Fall?
he called it the Great Fall.
We'll explain that term. Or the dive.
Right. Your impression of Superman. I grew up in Northern California, and I was, you know, when I was really young, kindergarten time, you know, I found out that my dad wasn't my biological father. I came home with my diploma from kindergarten, and it had his last name on it, and he sat me down. My parents sat me down, and they informed me that he wasn't my biological father. And I think, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of things I saw in the house leading up to that moment, but I believe that was very pivotal because, you know, he's not my real dad. And then where is my real dad kind of thing?
All those, you know, questions.
So, you know, as time went on, I witnessed a lot of abuse in my house, drugs, alcohol, smoking, partying, violence. You know, there were times where, you know, the police would show up to my house on a domestic situation and I'd watch my father take on four or five cops at one time. Back in my day, in the early 80s, you know, they approached domestic violence in those situations a little bit differently. Like he would go in and then hours later he would be out, but, you know, still under the influence at the end of the day. And then it would continue. Right. By the time I was about 8 years old, one of the neighborhood kids came by and encouraged me to go into a closet with him and did some things to me, some things that I had to keep a secret for a very, very long time. And that boy's dad was friends with my dad. And, you know, my dad was like this hard, tough Marine drinking, like he was just a tough dude. He was like, you know, he's the toughest guy I knew, right? And so, you know, bringing that kind of information to my dad wasn't going to be something I would do. So I held on to that, you know, along with holding on to that secret, I started getting snoopy in my house. I would go into my parents' room and I'd start thumbing through all their stuff and I'd find my dad's magazines and videos. And then I started watching and looking at that at such a young age. I was putting that stuff into my system. By the time I was in high school, my freshman year, I hadn't really drank or used up to that point. Even though it was all around me, it was just not, I was still really young. It didn't really appeal to me, but I remember going over to my girlfriend's house and her parents were out of town, but dad's best friend was over at the house and he ended up buying us alcohol and he got us intoxicated. And I watched a grown man take advantage of my 14-year-old girlfriend right in front of me. And so, you know, I'm veering off into this path, you know, with the intimacy, the relational stuff. And now you've introduced alcohol into my life. What I realized also during that night when all those things happened is that everything that was happening at home, I got to kind of break away from when I was under the influence. And that was very appealing to me. And so that started the path of me drinking and then being introduced to marijuana and then acid, ecstasy, cocaine. Like I just started introducing all these drugs into my system and into my life. I was always looking for an escape. I didn't like being alone. I didn't like being in my head ever. I was extremely, I had a lot of suicidal ideations. When I was in high school, I would come home with pictures of a guy putting a gun to his head, you know, and I struggled with wanting to be here in this world for a really long time. In my later teens, I ended up going to a drive-in and sneaking in the drive-in through the back of my my buddy's trunk of his Mustang. And when we snuck in, I jumped out and started making all sorts of racket. I'd been drinking and smoking and doing some things. And the guy that we pulled up to didn't like my behavior. He didn't like the commotion I was bringing. And so it got confrontational and he pulled out a shotgun on me. And I just remember in that moment, you know, encouraging him to pull the trigger. I encouraged him.
You didn't care that moment.
No, I just didn't care, man. And I mean, my friends that I came with, they were all scared. The girls were screaming. They were telling me to stop. And so he doesn't pull the trigger. He packs up and he leaves. But at that point, the cops were called. Cops show up. And now I'm livid. And the cops tried to calm me down. And one cop put his hand on my shoulder. And I threw him to the ground. And then I remember getting rushed by the cops and then wrestling them until they won, basically. I wasn't going to win that match. But that was my teens. You know, a lot of that kind of stuff happened. I got deeper into the drugs, deeper into the alcohol, deeper into the violence. I like to fight a lot. It's something I like to do. If it wasn't for a lot of my friends that prevented a lot of those fights, I probably would have been in a lot more. In my 20s, you know, I was in and out of jobs. You know, I could hold on to a job for a little while, but then I'd become friends with everybody and we'd start partying together. And then they'd see the dark side of me. They'd see the demons come out with the drugs and the alcohol. Eventually, I met a young lady in my late 20s and we started dating. And at this point, you know, I didn't mind chaotic relationships. I mean, it almost was a stimulus.
That was life to you, it sounds like, chaos.
Yeah, chaos was my drug. I didn't know how to deal without it. I didn't know how to move without it. And we eventually got into a bit of a domestic situation. We broke up. And during our breakup, I had taken an invitation to a Bible study. I had a buddy that I worked with or used to work with that was always trying to encourage me to come to his Bible study and invite Jesus into my life and all this stuff. And, you know, for the longest time, it's like, you know, bro, I'm glad that works for you. That doesn't work for me. You know, I was baptized Catholic. I had some form of religion and an idea of who Jesus was. But I think deep down inside, it's like, you know, if I walk it out with Jesus, I'm going to have to stop a lot of things and I'm not ready to stop a lot of those things. But I end up getting invited to this Bible study and these men, they all just started praying for me, laying hands on me. And I started shaking and sweating. Not that I was anxious or fearful or anything. It's just something was happening. And I walked away from that, like, refreshed. But shortly after that, I found out that my ex that I had recently broken up with had gotten to escorting. So, you know, early in the 2000s, we had Craigslist where you could get escorts on Craigslist, right? That was a thing. Well, my buddy had spotted her on Craigslist, and he reached out to me. And I was in a place of like, yeah, bad stuff happened between us, but like, that's no lifestyle for a young lady, especially someone that I still care for. So I made my way back into her life. I was still struggling with the drugs and the alcohol, even though I just had this fresh experience with faith. And she ended up going on a trip. So the deal was, you know, let's get rid of all your clients and we'll work out the relationship. And, but she had to go on this very last one. It was very lucrative for her. It paid out a lot of money. And while she was over there, you know, she was sending me pictures and texts of, you know, telling me what had happened to her to a certain degree. Like it was very, it was basically short of, you know, he raped me and he beat me. Like she, it was like one step under, but it, like, I got it. Like, I know what you're saying. Right. So during that conversation, she said, you know, when I get home, let's just work it all out. Like, I'm committed to that. And so I was cool with that. She came home from that trip, and we ended up back at her loft. And we got into a conversation that just was super uneasy and uncomfortable. And I went downstairs, and I had been drinking that day. We had actually stopped off at the liquor store when she came to pick me up to bring me back to her house from that airport. And I went downstairs to rest it off. And I woke up to a banging at the door. And she comes down the stairs and I ask her what's going on. And she says, I called the cops and told them that you raped me and tried to kill me. And in that moment, I just, between the fear, the betrayal, the confusion, the adrenaline, I just decided that rather go to prison for something I didn't do, that I would rather just take my life. So I ran headfirst out of a third story loft window, supermanned it. I believe my foot clipped an awning, changed my fall, and I ended up severing my spine, breaking both of my arms and collapsing my lung. And I was sent to the hospital for a 10-hour surgery to wake up to the police arresting me for rape, attempted murder. And they threw the cuffs on me and they threw $1 million bail on me. And then I was, given 24-hour police surveillance on top of it. And while I was in the hospital, one of the cops that was on a shift, he started kind of grilling me, saying that he was reading my case, that I was this really bad guy, and that what the men in prison were going to do to me were just unspeakable. And I started to break down, and I asked him, he told me that he had read everything, and that, you know, that I had a lot of bad stuff coming my way. And I told him, I said, you know, I've done a lot of bad things in my life, but that just wasn't one of them. That wasn't one of them. And I really truly did care about this girl. And I broke down crying. And a nurse had to come in, settle me down, because I had just had these major surgeries. I had these blood transfusions. The blood wasn't taking. I mean, I was struggling. I was struggling in the hospital. And as she's leaving, the young lady comes in with her sister in a disguise with a folder in her hand. And the cop's demeanor just changed. And he's like, is that who I think that is? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, that doesn't make sense. And he escorted her out of the building. At that point, I was resting in bed and I was talking to God and I was asking God, like, what are we going to do? Like, what happens from here on out? Cause I'm broken to pieces. I'm hooked up to all these machines. Things are absolutely chaotic. And, you know, I'm facing prison.
Let me plug something in here.
At what point was it, and maybe you're getting ready to tell us, but the report you got from the doctors had to place some mental anguish on you as well about your future?
They said I may never walk again.
Okay.
Yeah, because I severed my spine. So I basically, my L2 and my lower back was completely detached from, like, millimeters short of this completely snapping off. And so I couldn't even sit up. There was nothing I could do. Like, I was in immense amount of pain, so much that I had Dilaudid and morphine being shot through me, just to reduce some of the pain. But I felt it all. I felt the pain, and I just sat there and I asked God. I was like, you know, what do we do? Like, what happens from here on out? And I just recall this calm, this peace that came over me. And if anyone's ever spent time in the hospital, there's lights, there's no noises, there's intercoms, there's doctors, there's nurses, there's medication, there's oxygen. You know, there's just a number of things that just aren't peaceful, right? But this a peace came over me, and clear as day I heard, charges will be dropped, bills will be paid, and you will walk. I woke up back to all the chaos, and one of the cops that came in was like, "Hey, Decker, I just want to let you know that you're being released this weekend. They're going to drop the charges." And, so that was the first one that happened. And shortly after that, my mom came to visit me. She was my first guest. Since I was on lockdown in the hospital, I wasn't allowed to have guests. So my mom just happened to get there at the right time. I saw her talking to the doctor. I saw her weeping in the hallway. And I asked her what happened and what was going on. And she told me everything was going to be okay, but I knew it wasn't. Well, I knew it was, but I knew that's not what was going on with her. And she admitted to me that the doctor said I may never walk again. That was what she admitted to me. They came in, neurosurgeon came in and said that we're going to give you another surgery. We're going to give it a shot. So they did. So I was given another back surgery. And at this point I was able to sit up at the edge of my bed, get on both of my feet, and I was able to drag my left foot out of the bedroom into the hallway. And I was super excited about that because I knew that I was going to walk again.
Absolutely.
It was going to be a rough road. I will promise you that. It was going to be a super rough road, but
How long before you were able to walk from that point to where you felt like you had a good gait, you were stable?
A good gait took quite some time, to be honest with you. A good gait was a while because, you know, I landed on the left side of my body, so that accrued most of the injury. I hit the concrete so hard that it blew my L2 to the right side of my body, where when they pulled it back, they couldn't even straighten it out. They couldn't line it back up with the rest of the spine. Currently my back doesn't have a curve in the lower back, and it's slightly scoliosis based on the structural damage. I have my own challenges with the way that I move, but I kept working at it. I kept walking. I kept trying to run. I eventually got back into the gym. I had to put myself in a situation of getting strong again. And during this time, I was still seeking out faith. I was still praying, but I was struggling. I was struggling so, so, so much. And I think that the biggest turn for me was when I was living with my mom. So I was in the hospital for 6 weeks. My mom had me move in with her, and I was sleeping on her couch trying to get better. And she came home one day, and, I just broke down crying. I was just like, you know, mom, thanks for being my mom. And, you know, and my mom sat down with me and had a heart to heart, You know, she basically told me the things that she had been through in this life about, you know, running away, being raped by a family member, being told she would never get pregnant, that she gets pregnant with me. And then, you know, my mom had a really hard life. And when she was sharing all that with me, like I stopped looking at her as my mom that I expected so much from my whole life. And I saw her as a broken young woman that did her best to do what she could. Right.
That moment of understanding of who she was and what she was about had to be very revealing to you.
It was, and my heart just, you know, she needed forgiveness and grace just as much as I did. And then she told me about my dad who raised me. So I call him my dad because he raised me from 6 months old. But then she told me stories about him and the things that he had been through. And he was a product of, you know, grandpa raping grandma. And, you know, when he got home from the military, he walked in on his wife sleeping with another man. Like the amount of angst and trauma in his life as well that he may have never came to terms with. And both of my parents drank and used drugs and tried to raise kids. They had their own demons. They were running from their own problems.
There's that, you know, chaos we were talking about earlier that just engulfed you in so many ways, from the generational experiences to your own.
Yeah, it was all generational stuff, and it was just getting passed down to me. And but you know, that started me on a decent path of a good recovery, and I kept pursuing God. But you know, for 4.5 years, I still struggled with pain medication, cocaine, and alcohol. You know, marijuana as well. I still struggled because there were just things that I had a hard time dealing with, and self-medicating was always my go-to.
Your answer.
It was my answer. It was the solution for my problem. And I'll say this, I don't believe drugs and alcohol was ever my problem. I'm not going to sit here and say that I ever had a disease or that, you know, once this, always that. Like, that's just not the camp that I'm in personally for my own health and my own growth. I truly believe that I learned things from what I saw growing up. I self-medicated, and what I have to do is take 100% responsibility and accountability for the decisions that I made by choosing to run away from my problems and not deal with them. And that's kind of where I sit in a lot of this stuff. And so for 4.5 years, I continued to self-medicate until I got behind the wheel of my girlfriend's car, who is now my wife. But, you know, my life was given back to me, man. I wasn't taking all these pain meds. I was working a job. I was told that I may never walk again or work again. If I did, I'd be fully medicated, living off a disability. Like, you know, that's kind of where, you know, that's what I was told. And here I was, like, flourishing again in life, but still running to drugs and alcohol as an answer for me. Because I didn't know how to handle certain stressors in my life. And I ended up getting behind the wheel of my girlfriend's car, crashing into someone's property, leaving the scene of the crime, and hiding under someone's porch. And I was just like, here we are again, God. Here we are again. I'm just throwing it all away. And I remember being under that house and was like, I need your help. I need your help big time. I don't deserve your help. You know, you're righteous. I deserve consequences for my decisions. I do. But I started negotiating. Like,
don't we all?
But if you bail me out of this situation, I will never drink and use drugs ever again. If you want me to marry Alyssa, I will marry Alyssa. We are living in Northern California. She wanted to go back home to Southern California. I will move with her. We will start a family. If this is your will for my life, I am willing to do it all. I will give up all this stuff. And then, like, in the hospital, I was now given a vision versus hearing audibly. I was given this vision of the comeback, that 4-year comeback of how my life was given back to me. And it was so good after everything that was being told to me. And my heart just broke in that moment. My heart broke. It's like I literally felt it turn in my chest and break. And I just surrendered it all. I surrendered it all to God. And in that moment of surrender and repentance, I felt this heaviness. While still intoxicated, I felt this heaviness leave my body, and I knew that I was never going to run back to drugs and alcohol again. That was January 8th of 2013. I haven't run back to drugs and alcohol. No temptations to do so whatsoever.
Congrats.
Thank you. Because I wish that was everybody's story, right? I wish it was. But, you know, I went 20 years from 14 to 34 struggling with drug and alcohol abuse. You know, that's what I did, you know, dealing with unresolved trauma. But then I've made it my life's work to now meet people where they're at in their process of recovery and faith and addiction, you know, and to see them for the broken, lost soul that they are, with the hopes of helping, with the hopes of giving them some kind of guidance and help and hope to move in the right direction of sobriety, but not just sobriety. Sobriety to me was icing on the cake. Sobriety was the first step. Sobriety was the first step of unpacking the unhealed traumas and pains and hurts, neglect, rejection, you know, isolation, like all of it.
You've like obviously done a lot of internal work looking at your own personal experience. And I so loved what you had to say about it's not a matter of if it's a disease. I am responsible. And I've got to start with me before I can use any other excuse or any other reasoning that I got myself into this with God's help. We can get me out of it. And you're getting there as you're telling us now. Continue to tell us where that's taking you at this point, Rob.
Well, I will also enlighten you with this is that, you know, early on before I actually quit, you know, I was already walking with God and doing research and studying, right? But still acting a fool. You know, the word pharmacy, where we get, you know, our pharmaceuticals, where it comes from a Greek word, pharmakia, right? When you look up that word, it means witchcraft or sorcery. See, here's the thing. I knew that when I was putting drugs in my system, that I was virtually inflicting a spiritual issue with inside of me, that I was summoning things that weren't of God. I was allowing things that were of the dark side in me, around me, through me. Right? Alcohol comes from the Arabic word al-kul. Al-kul means flesh eating spirit. So I was taking alcohol, not to say that drinking is bad, you know, self-control. And, but when you start getting buzzed and drunk and you're using it for all the wrong reasons, well, now I'm allowing other spirits to consume me because you can drive past the liquor store. Alcohol is still called a spirit, right? I understood the spiritual ramifications of the things that I was doing to myself. And I think that's one of the understandings that I needed was the life that I live is extremely spiritual and I'm living in this physical world, right? And so now with the work that I do, I understand that not everybody sees it with that same lens, right? But I want to be able to meet people where they're at. And I do it through my nonprofit organization, my book, God's Awning, that just recently came out. The podcasts, you know, I've been on CBN 700 Club. They're about to come out here in a week to do a story on my recovery softball teams. I've been invited by TBN to one of their shows to talk about my book. I've been in magazines. I've been able to use almost every social platform, social media, to be able to share my story and to help people in their journey. And so with my nonprofit Rises Lions, we build recovery centered softball teams. And when I look at recovery, I look at the healing journey. I'm not saying that this is strictly drug and alcohol abuse. Drug and alcohol abuse is the Band-Aid. you know,
it's the symptom of the problem.
And a lot of people don't understand that. And it's like, we need to unpack the deeper things in this life. And for me, the first step to healing was forgiveness. If anyone takes anything away from this, your parents may have not been very good to you. Most of the time, they were kids with their own problems trying to figure it out themselves. They made choices based on things that have happened to them as well. And I think that we need to start by forgiving those people that did harm to us, because sometimes that's all they knew. They just didn't know better. Even if when they do, they self-sabotage. So forgiveness was that first step. And then looking at myself and forgiving the things that I did to myself, how I acted to others, because you don't want to live in a place of guilt and shame and judgment all the time either, because that's a disease. You want to talk about a disease? Living in those attributes is the ultimate life killer, right? So I had to start addressing all those. And trust me, forgiveness can be very hard, because we can still be engaging with people that did harm to us, right? Now we create healthy boundaries, right? We have to be able to understand what's healthy, what needs to be in our life, what does not be. And a lot of that, a lot of those characteristics weren't taught to us. I've had to figure that out in my own recovery, in my own healing journey, navigating that. Has it been flawless? Absolutely not.
Something you've reminded me of throughout much of our conversation here, and I can't tell you where it can be found, but the idea, it says in God's word, he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him.
Yes.
And it goes back to you talking about, you know, you were studying, you were researching, you were looking into it. And finally, you must have got to the point to where you had what you felt you needed. You were able to give it up, give it over to God. And the way God's economy works is that when we have that moment of total surrender, he's got something to give us, something to share. And I've always said we're blessed for one reason only, and that's so we can bless others.
I agree.
I'm going to guess you couldn't count the number of times other than the suicide attempt to where you could have lost your life. You know, the guy with the shotgun that you mentioned earlier, you said you were big into fights, one blow even, in a not-so-violent fight.
And think about all the times I got behind the wheel and intoxicated.
Exactly.
The moment that I was able to drive, how many parties we went to, how intoxicated I got. I would show up, I would go outside and look at my car with new bumps and bruises on it and be like, I made it home. I don't remember getting in the house. I don't know how I got there. My car was parked. You start seeing the grace of God in a lot of those situations. I think a lot of times when you have a victim mindset, which I spent a lot of time there, I spent a lot of time being a victim because I was victimized. But at some point you take ownership and
you have to.
Am I going to do with these things? I'm now going to use those things that were meant to hurt me to help others. That's what I'm going to do with it now. You know, and you just, a lot of times the victim mindset is that we focus on the things we got in trouble for, or how we got offended and hurt, but we don't really look at the things that we got away with, you know, by the grace of God. And we know that we shouldn't have, with all the trouble I've ever been in my life, that was really a slap on the wrist compared to a lot of things that I partook of.
Amen.
We got to see.
Share with us how we can get our hands on your book. We've just got a few more minutes here, 7 or 8. Yeah. Share with us how we can get your book.
Yeah, if you go onto Amazon and look up God's Awning, check out all the reviews. I do encourage you, though, that if you read the book, please leave a review. The reviews help the algorithm of, the book. And so when people are looking up self-help, spirituality, God, recovery, addiction kind of stuff, my book would be one of the first ones to pop up there when you have reviews and 5 stars and all that kind of stuff. And don't give me 5 stars if you don't think I deserve 5 stars. I'm just saying, like, you know.
If it does hit you, let us all know.
It doesn't hurt. But yeah, man, you know, if you go to risesLines.org, which is our nonprofit organization where we build recovery-centered softball teams, you know, there's a link on there where you can just go to, you know, to Amazon and click on the book. And also for the listener, you know, feel free to reach out to me. I know a lot of times in this journey, it feels alone. You feel alone. You feel very lonely. A lot of times we struggle to take it to our parents, our family, our work, our church. A lot of times we don't even feel okay going to our pastor and people in the congregation, man. You don't know me, and that could work to your advantage right now. I'll respond to emails, texts, and if we got to get on a phone call for something, you know, I have no problem praying with you. I have no problem kind of hashing things out. My hope and my heart for you is that my story plants seeds in your heart to know that there is hope in the healing of moving on from a lot of the things that you're holding on to. Because there's freedom in that. And now I get to live a free life away from a lot of the things that had happened to me.
So, Rob, what's the next step for you? I know you've got another book coming out. I mean, more internal than that, okay? That's important. You've got a lot to share with that. But what's the next step for Rob and his life toward the continued recovery, that long journey?
Well, recovery is giving back at this point, right? And so, you know, I was telling you before the show, you know, I broke my leg February 1st and it forced me to be down. And that being down allowed me to write 50 or 65 stories to either my new book, my next new books. So I'm going to continue to get my life stories out there and encourage people. In May, I'm working on putting together a recovery mental health softball tournament here in Colorado Springs. We want to bring awareness to mental health and recovery. We don't want people to feel shamed because they're struggling. You know, we need to have these conversations. This has to become normal so that people can trust other humans so that we can start healing as a community, because we need each other at the end of the day. So I'm going to continue to put myself out there in my community, into this world internationally, through TV, podcasts, magazines, books, whatever it is that I'm asked to do, with the hopes that someone hears the message and it puts them on the right path.
Amen. I love that attitude. I love that, that direction. All right. I'll tell you what, if you got something you'd like to wrap this up with, we'd love to hear a final word.
Yeah, you know, I would just say don't lose hope. You know, I think that there's somebody that's listening right now that was just on the edge of losing all hope. You know, I'm hoping that something within my story, and I didn't even get to share a bunch of my story. I do encourage you to get the book, not because I want the money, but because I want you to heal. There will be stories in there that you may be able to relate to, and you'll see how I came out of it. And I am always up for discussion to have that. I don't want you to lose hope. I know what it feels like to be hopeless, because that's when we unalive ourselves. That's when we feel like we're not loved and we have no purpose here. We do. We are loved. We are loved. The enemy is going to creep in and tell you that you have no value, that you are not loved. Right. And he's going to want his primary responsibility is to kill, steal, and destroy. Keep that in mind. Okay. Let the Lord work in your life. And if you don't know what that looks like, give me a call.
Folks, what more of an invitation could you ask for? There's help. It's possible. We've just listened to it. You've watched it through somebody who's been there, done that. I'm sure has plenty of scars to prove it, internally and externally.
I mean, I got a lot of hardware, man. I swear. So I don't have a retirement plan. In my will, it's like, babe, just recycle me. There's so much hardware.
Yeah.
Make money off that titanium, man.
See what the value is on the market. Dig it out of there. Yeah, yeah.
I'm like a cyborg at this point in my life. But I will say this, you know, if you choose to reach, I will share my x-rays with you. You can see the amount of craziness in my body. You know, I'm friends with my neurosurgeon, and he told me that I've had one of the most extensive back surgeries that he's ever performed, right? But he says, I am within that handful of individuals that live life to the fullest. But not only that, I'm at the top of the list, and it's only because of my willingness not to give up, yep, and to fight the fight, and to take care of my body, to eat well, right? There are things that we can do to help this, to help our mental health, right? And our spiritual walk.
Yeah. Listen, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing with us. I kind of want to close with this comment that we just received from Harley Curtis Nation of our Burn chapter of A Better Life, Brianna's Hope. Here's what he says. I've been slipping backwards the past few weeks, and listening to another testimony helps out so much. Thanks for the insight, Bubba. Well, Bubba, thanks for being with us. God bless you. Continue to stay in the battle. We're here. We'd love to hear from you again, and I'm sure we'll be in touch. So, folks, thanks for tuning in, and understand, a cat only has 9 lives, and most of us seem to think we've got more than one. In this case,
I'm going to say
we've heard somebody here who's fought that battle and come out on top. And the lowest point was lower than hitting that concrete from that fall, that dive, okay?
Yeah.
So God has blessed, and he's blessed us to get to hear your story, and maybe we're why you're here today. I don't care either way. We got to share it. Take care. Stay in the battle. God bless.
God bless.